From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the passing of an automotive icon, Lee Iacocca.
If you can find a better car, buy it.
It was defining for people of a certain generation to hear that. You got to give him points for moxie.
Fighting to lower Michigan's maternal and infant mortality rates, both in rural and urban areas.
What we see here is a lack of primary care. And so a lot of these women have some chronic conditions that just aren't taken care of, and then they get pregnant and they get very sick.
We have to come at the issue from a political perspective, a community perspective, and a care perspective, all three.
The life of Betty Bloomer of Grand Rapids, who became First Lady Betty Ford.
She said that the day she entered the White House in 1974 was the saddest day of her life.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was the last of an era, the only person to lead two of Detroit's big three. And if you've owned a Mustang or a minivan, you can credit him. Lee Iacocca died Tuesday of complications from Parkinson's disease. He was 94. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, just how big a shadow did Lee Iacocca cast, not only across the U.S. auto industry, but indeed the world auto industry?
Well, I think huge, frankly. I think he was the last of the supreme automotive leaders, you know, the all-knowing, all-seeing, powerful CEO. We have now a model that's more coach, more global, more diverse, all those kinds of buzzwords. And it's all true. But he came from a different era. He came up in the post-war era when the United States economic prosperity was pretty much unparalleled. And the auto industry based in Detroit reached its zenith, frankly, in the 1960s. That's when he and a small team conceived the Mustang in 1964, blew the doors off. And today it is the only mark, the only brand that Ford cars are sound, this being sold as a Ford cars.
Yeah.
Everything else is trucks and SUVs, but the Mustang lives. You mentioned the minivan at the top. The minivan lives. The last year, as he retired from Chrysler in 1992, they launched the Jeep Grand Cherokee, which is the cornerstone of Jeep, the brand that continues to grow around the world and in the United States. And they got it when Iacocca acquired American Motors in 1987, much to the consternation of a lot of people, said, why are you doing this? And now you look at what they have now in Jeep, that is the cornerstone of the company going forward.
He was quite the visionary. For those who are maybe perhaps not quite of our vintage, mm-hmm. Kind of briefly walk us through kind of his career first at Ford, why he left after Henry Ford II fired him, and then headed across town at Chrysler. Give us kind of the big picture.
Well, real quick, he grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He went to Lehigh University in nearby Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, came very gritty steel country, got a degree in engineering, did a brief some brief studies at Princeton, but got into the Ford management program in engineering, quickly kind of thought that that was not his thing, as I understand it, moved over to sales and marketing, and that was really his path to the top, came up with some really innovative ideas, including what they called 56 and 56, 56 for a $20, 20% rather, down payment. You'd pay $56 a month, and then you would own a new Ford. It really turned his region around and became a model that the company used around the country. Came to Dearborn, worked his way up through the company, and as you said, became president under Hank, the famous Hank the Deuce, who after about, I think, 7 or 8 years, fired him. When Iacocca asked him why, he said, sometimes you just don't like somebody. and then Henry Ford, in his inimitable style, who often said, never explain and never complain, declined to ever explain anymore about why he did what he did. he did what he did because he could and because his name was on the building. Very quickly, Iacocca is recruited by John Ricardo over at Chrysler to come be the CEO there. And he lands at... at Chrysler, and very quickly, Chrysler, he finds, is in facing an existential crisis. And it's at that point, to stave off bankruptcy, that he goes to Washington and is able to persuade the politicians and later the American people to back the idea of federal loan guarantees, which is not a bankruptcy and it was not a bailout. They were loan guarantees. President Carter signed them. They went ahead with them, and Chrysler fast forward, pays them back ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
I don't even think used them all, frankly. And there his ticket was punched as one of the great turnaround guys of the modern era.
And then, of course, you know, he became the face long before there was somebody like a Steve Jobs, where you associated him with the company. He was Chrysler. Let's listen to one of Lee Iacocca's many commercials for Chrysler.
Nobody has anything like them. Not Ford, not GM, not the imports. I challenge you to compare their quality and technology to anything that comes out of Germany or Japan. No cars are perfect, but these come pretty close. Drive them. See for yourself how quiet and smooth they are. If you don't agree they're the best Chrysler's ever made, the very best America has to offer at a sensible price, then I'm in the wrong business. Oh, one more thing. If you can find a better car, buy it.
That famous, famous tagline. What worked so
Unfortunately, they probably could at the time. But you got to give him points for moxie. Listen, it was defining for people of certainly of a certain generation to hear that. It was very unusual for a CEO of a car company. Even as today, I mean, you don't see Mary Barra or Al Mulally or Jim Hackett or Sergio Marchionne or Mike Manley hawking their metal, not in television ads. But this was a very unique situation, and he was persuaded to do it and then build it into an even bigger persona. So you become, it's not, I suppose it's some roughly analogous to President Trump, you know, who had a television career, and that's how he became really well known to a lot of people. Same thing for Iacocca. He was on these TV commercials and became really well known, writes a best-selling memoir. I think wrote another one later on. And eventually becomes is considering running for president after President Ronald Reagan. And as I understand it, at least some of the people around him kind of convinced him that wasn't a good idea, because they realized that the president of the United States have a harder time getting things done than a CEO of a Detroit auto company.
There you go.
And a guy like Iacocca expects things to get done.
You know, it's worth noting, when Iacocca retired from Chrysler, mm-hmm. his successor was Bob Eaton, who made history by...
He made history by doing the Daimler Chrysler deal.
Yeah.
And the interesting note there is that in 1995, 3 years after Iacocca had retired, Eaton is running the company. Iacocca hooks up with Kirk Kerkorian, the billionaire casino mogul from Las Vegas. And they mount a hostile takeover of Chrysler. And all of a sudden, it was like, what the heck? You know, what is Lee Iacocca doing coming after the company? So he became persona non grata for a time in Auburn Hills. But that kind of began the process that a few years later, in 1997, led to the Daimler-Chrysler so-called merger of equals, one of the great lies of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
It was not a merger of equals by any stretch of the imagination, as I experienced covering it in Germany for the first 4 years of its existence.
Well, as you say in your piece in the news today, this really does mark the end of an era in terms of the auto industry.
Certainly does.
And as people get ready, we should note, for next month's Woodward Dream Cruise, you can certainly tip your hat and thank Lee Iacocca for every Mustang you see drive by on Woodward. Detroit
Absolutely.
News business columnist Daniel House. Daniel, thanks so much.
You bet.
You don't have to look at the calendar to know we're headed into the long 4th of July weekend. Just go out in your backyard and listen for the sounds of fireworks. Backyard fireworks celebrations got lots bigger with the Michigan Fireworks Safety Act of 2011. But legally bought bigger fireworks made for a lot of noise complaints, and lawmakers have been tweaking things since then. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here to tell us what we can and cannot do when we light up the night. Rick, just kind of remind us what that 2011 law did.
Right. Well, what it did was it created a block of days around federal holidays, most of them around the July 4th holiday, that said, here's when you can shoot off fireworks, blow up fireworks, without local ordinances getting in the way. And it set parameters that you can't shoot them off after 11 p.m. You know, we're talking about big fireworks. And so,
yeah, because didn't it let us buy bigger fireworks? So instead of trundling to Ohio to get stuff we didn't used to be able to buy, it was available here.
Yeah, which meant that fireworks sellers in Michigan benefited. And as a matter of fact, one of their complaints about this new version of the law is that it created new restrictions on when they could be sold. And they say, well, that's great for the big fireworks dealers, but not so great for small businesses.
So there's been tweaking since 2011. We almost immediately started getting a lot of public complaining about noises.
So I would dare say that arguing over what should and should not be allowed about fireworks in Michigan is as traditional as shooting them off on July 4th.
Very true. In fact, we're going to hear a lot more about that later in today's Stateside. So what is new this year? When they've been making tweaks. Was that in response to the complaints about noise?
Yeah, that was part of it, that there are problems, and I think there are two major ones. One is pets, that sometimes the big fireworks disturbed pets and made them nervous and antsy and bothersome. And also veterans, people who had served in combat, and these loud explosions were something of a trigger. And so the decision was made at the policymaking level that if we can't ban them, at least we can offer some predictability as to when they would be allowed and not allowed based on, I mean, local governments would still have to pass the ordinances, but, you know, you can go and lobby your local government about doing it. And what it said, though, is no matter where you are, no matter where you go up north on vacation, there are going to be periods of time when they're allowed. But then it's after, you know, other than that, it's a local decision.
Okay. So this year, isn't it true they've cut back on the number of days then that we can shoot off unrestricted fireworks when local governments cannot tell you no? What did we go from and what do we have now?
Well, I mean, all told, it used to be 30 days surrounding, you know, these federal holidays, and now it's shrunk down to 12. So it's a lot fewer, and so you can create more restrictions where people's peace and quiet won't be disturbed if local governments want it.
Right. And so this year we got from June 29th to July 5th to launch fireworks without getting in trouble, this unrestricted period. And how late can we go?
11:45 p.m. 11:46, you're in trouble.
Okay. You look like a sparkler.
I was going to say, I am so boring, I'm a sparkler guy.
So am I. Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta. Happy 4th. Thank you so much.
Same to you.
Coming up, we talk about the fight to reduce Michigan's maternal and infant mortality rates. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For every 1,000 babies born in Michigan, nearly 7 of those babies will not live to their first birthday. And that rate is more than double for African American and Native American babies. As part of its new effort to move the needle on infant mortality, Michigan is tailoring solutions to different communities. And today, we're going to meet two women addressing the challenge of infant mortality in very different parts of the state. Leslie Welch is a senior lecturer in public health at Wayne State University and executive director of Birthing Project USA. Leslie's worked on a lot of infant mortality initiatives in Detroit, including Sister Friends, which we've explored here on Stateside. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And Bethany Brown is with us. She's a public health nurse who's an assistant director in the nursing program at Central Michigan University and part of the state's regional infant mortality task force for parts of Central Michigan. Bethany, it's so good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So, Leslie, I'm going to start with you because I know there are so many programs in the Detroit area that have been working on infant and maternal health, trying to make a dent in the numbers for infant mortality for African-American babies, which stands at what in Detroit?
In Detroit, our infant mortality rate is actually 14.2. And so it is, you know, more than twice our number for the state.
So when you think of this racial gap, where are the gaps that need to be filled in?
I think that what is important for everybody to understand is that there is no magic bullet quick fix, that we really have to have the difficult conversations about race and racism, and about the political and social economic conditions of women's lives. And so from a public health perspective, we know that that means that addressing the context of people's lives is critically important. And so we have to come at the issue from a political perspective, a community perspective, and a care perspective. All three are very important.
And we think about the city of Detroit and the surrounding areas. They're home to a lot of hospitals and a lot of medical offices, but there are still problems with access to adequate prenatal care. Why is that?
I think there are still challenges around that because there are still challenges in general around families, lives, and transportation, right? And so we know that we need to address the challenges, the larger challenges that families are having, whether it be around income levels and poverty, whether it is housing, whether it's transportation access. Those larger factors complicate how women are able to access the care that exists.
Let's switch over to Isabella County with the second highest infant mortality rate behind Wayne County, despite being a very different, much more rural area. Bethany, what are the factors that are driving that high rate of infant mortality in Isabella County?
Well, Isabella County is a different world. It's much different than the Detroit area. I originally started my practice in Muskegon Heights, Michigan, as a nurse midwife and women's health nurse practitioner. Then came over here to the middle of the state, and some of the situations like transportation and resources are still a huge problem like they are for Detroit and for Muskegon. But here in Isabella County, we have space, lots of space and limited providers. And that causes problems when you don't have money for transportation, you don't have money for gas, for phone, to get adequate care. In Isabella County in 2017, the infant mortality rate was 11.7, the second highest in our state. We have to look at things like implicit bias for the different populations of people that are here. And that needs to start at the education level, how we train our healthcare providers. And that's going to be a huge undertaking, but it is so very important. And I see this in medicine and nursing starting to change. But yes, definitely an issue. And we actually started at CMU a street medicine clinic where we take care of the homeless. And we've had a large influx of pregnant women, high risk pregnant women, not only because they're homeless, but for other medical reasons as well, that just go unnoticed, uncared for. So definitely an issue.
When you say implicit bias, what is that? Can you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah. So an implicit bias is when a person has these upbringings and beliefs that they may not be completely aware of, and it shapes how we make decisions and care for people. We can't control how we were raised and the environment we were raised in, but when we start to realize that it affects how we take care of people, then we can start making better decisions for their care. So we're doing a lot of implicit bias training in the state of Michigan. It's hard for physicians and nurses to take time off of work and do this. That's why I say it's going to take time, it's going to take patience, and it's going to take starting at the training level within our university systems.
And Leslie, you kind of opened the door to this a bit earlier, talking about the problem of racism as a factor in the health disparities that impact African Americans. Can you explain to us a little bit more about how racism plays this role in infant mortality?
Yes. I think one of the best ways I've heard it put, this issue, is that our disparities that we're seeing in infant mortality and maternal mortality are symptoms of a society that does not value all women and children equally. And that really is the core of racism. Is that we have, you know, created this false belief in a hierarchy of human value. And it impacts our distribution of resources and opportunity based on race, which has no biological basis. And it creates the larger inequities in the context of our lives. And then when we look at care, we notice differences in how providers listen to or don't listen to, acknowledge or minimize the pain of women, ignore symptomology, disregard decisions and wishes, all around race. And so it is critical that we address both how and why racism is part and parcel of the larger challenges we see, right, around our income levels, housing, poverty, and so forth. But also, even when we take that away and we look at Black women or women of color in general, who may have economic means, who may have education, and may have all of the access in the world, we are still treated differently based on race. And we have seen in one of the most public cases, in the case of Serena Williams, who has all of the resources in the world, that she was challenged to have her providers listen to her care concerns and challenges immediately following her pregnancy. And so we have to acknowledge and move beyond this idea that we could just coordinate and integrate services to understand that we also have to address respect and rights and freedom and quality and culturally responsive healthcare.
Cindy, this is also a factor in Isabella County. And when we look at maternal mortality along with the infant mortality, what we see here is a lack of primary care. And so a lot of these women have some chronic conditions that just aren't taken care of, and then they get pregnant and they get very sick. So again, opening up the doors to providers and coming up with resources and programs that help support people to come to the rural areas to care for people is very important.
And Bethany Brown, how does that echo what you see in Isabella County, which is home to the reservation of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribal Nation? Native American babies in our state face very high rates of infant mortality. What are the challenges for that population?
Correct. The challenges are the same as we would look at racial disparities in the same way. Their beliefs, their cultures are different than a lot of the providers that are out there providing the care, and sometimes are not respected and disregarded. And we're not making an effort to work with the family, work with the woman and her child to come up with the best plan of care that surrounds their needs and their issues and what's important to them. Not necessarily always what we see as a priority, but what they see as a priority is we have to start at that point. We also deal with, because it's in the middle of Michigan and it's very rural, we deal with lack of being able to get to the people. So we're looking at, in Isabella County, grants and other things that may help us to provide mobile prenatal care or certified nurse midwives that will integrate. They're trained in dealing with the at-risk population and getting out to their houses and the places where they're at and meeting the patients in their home where they're at, and having a better understanding of the issues that are more important to them.
And certainly when we think of the rural community, you can't not think of the impact of the opioid epidemic on rural parts of our state. So does that have an impact when it comes to maternal and infant health in Isabella and surrounding counties?
Absolutely. The opioid epidemic is a huge problem, and not only because the people who are addicted to these drugs have health issues, and then the infants also will have surrounding health issues when they're born, but also because that just compounds the implicit bias problems we have with providers, doctors, nurses, physician assistants, etc., is that they have these beliefs about addiction that may not even be true, or they may not even realize themselves, and that further provides an opportunity for bad service and bad care for these patients who just need some understanding and some help.
If you just joined us, we're talking about addressing the problem of infant mortality in two different parts of the state. From Detroit, we're talking with Leslie Welch, and from central Michigan, in the middle of Michigan, Isabella County, we're talking with Bethany Brown, both of them public health workers who are trying to bring down that infant mortality rate. And I want to kind of dig into what's making a difference when it comes to making things better for moms and their babies. Leslie, what do you see that's working in Detroit?
So I think one of the beautiful things about Detroit is that we do have such a rich community of programs, initiatives, organizations, and providers working around this issue, actually over 100. And we have a strong community also of midwives, of doulas, and community birth advocates. And one of The recent initiatives is Hope Starts Here, an initiative of the Kellogg Foundation and Kresge Foundations. And their vision is that by 2027, Detroit will be a city that puts its children and families first. And they have put together a multidisciplinary collaborative effort around six different strategy areas to improve the lives of families with the focus on the first 8 years of children's lives. And I think that that is critically important. And we also have folks who have been at work in the community for a very long time with programs like Healthy Start, the Women Inspired Neighborhood Network, Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association, and in the last few years, Sister Friends Detroit. I'd also add that we can do more as well to leverage community-based midwifery here in Detroit. And so we have an organization, Metro Detroit Midwives of Color, that's working to improve the diversity of the midwifery community and enhance care that women receive. And I'm also a part of now a local effort called Birth Detroit that is working to develop a community-based women's wellness and birth center here in the city.
So having a birthing center, that right there for women to really focus on, what's it going to take to get that? And what difference do you hope that could make?
It will take a lot of capital fundraising and investment to make it a reality, both in terms of physical space, provider pay, and program development. And our hope and our vision is that we can make the midwifery model of care that we know, you know, works well in hospitals. And also, we know that community-based midwifery care starts to diminish some of the disparities that we see in the maternal infant health outcomes. And we hope to make the model of care available to all birthing persons in the city, regardless of ability to pay.
And Bethany, what's working in Isabella County and mid-Michigan? What are some of the most effective initiatives?
Well, Leslie, I have to tell you, I'm extremely jealous because I went to the University of Michigan and did a lot of work on the east side of the state. And then I moved back home to Muskegon and then now in the middle of Michigan. And we don't have the resources or the people that you do. And we definitely are behind times when it comes to care in a lot of places. When it, you know, I would practice at U of M and then I came over to West Michigan and we were 5-6 years behind what I was doing over there. So it's very frustrating for me at times because getting the interdisciplinary care team together to work on it can be quite difficult around here. We definitely need to strive to integrate nurse midwifery care as a collaborative practice. There's not a lot of it here in the middle of Michigan or in the west upper side of Michigan. And we need to get more people politically involved in the health and well-being of women and children. The state of Michigan is doing that with their maternal infant health equity collaboration. And as being part of that for Region 5, we are looking at bringing different kinds of people to the table and trying to get a good representation of who we serve. So I hope that's a huge first step to understanding exactly all the problems that we need to solve or what we need to pay attention to. And we start to look at different ways in a different care model than the usual to provide services to people who are in these rural areas.
The state has set an ambitious goal of zero preventable infant deaths, zero health disparities. How long, first of all, do you think that will happen? Will the state reach that goal? And how long do you think it would take to do that? What do you think, Leslie?
I think that it can be done. I think that the truth is, as a state, as a nation, we know we can do better. We also know what it takes to do better, right? And so if we commit to intentionally working on improving the context of families' lives, like improving their economic opportunity, improving housing, childcare, pay equity, those things in combination with improving our care systems and enforcing or promoting standards of respectful care at birth and really leveraging community-based models of care and meeting families where they are, we can absolutely do that. There's no reason to think we can't.
Bethany Brown, you get the last word.
Oh, man. Yes, We can do that, and it has to start with respecting women and respecting that women come from a diversity of situations, not just their racial backgrounds, but how they grew up and what they know. And if you don't meet the woman where she is and take into account the things that truly matter to her, you're not going to help solve the problem she has with her family and help protect the health of herself and the well-being of her child. So we can do better at being more involved in starting more initiatives to look at women and the diversity that they bring to the state. And if we do that and we truly respect the humanity of families, I think Michigan can improve that.
Two of the advocates working very, very hard on behalf of moms and their babies in our state, Leslie Welch working in Detroit and Bethany Brown working in mid-Michigan in Isabella County. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
After the break, the courageous life of Michigan's First Lady, Betty Ford.
Women started lining up at doctors' offices, calling their doctors to get breast exams because Betty said, you know, early detection is what saved my life.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On August 9, 1974, Richard Nixon resigned as President of the United States. That historic moment thrust Gerald and Betty Ford into the White House. It placed the Grand Rapids native into history as America's 38th president and his first lady. Lisa McCubbin is the New York Times bestselling author of Betty Ford, First Lady, Woman's Advocate, Survivor, Trailblazer. Her biography tracks Betty Ford's life as arguably one of our most influential first ladies. I spoke with McCubbin late last year. Your book covers the entire gamut of Betty Ford's life. So let's go back to those early years as Betty Bloomer grew up in Grand Rapids. What was going on in those early years that portends the very honest, outspoken first lady that she became?
Well, she had a very strong mother figure. Her mother, Hortense Bloomer, was basically a single mom. So Betty had two older brothers, Bill and Bob, and her father was a traveling salesman. So he would be gone for weeks at a time. So her mother really had to raise the kids. You know, she was a strong-willed woman, and I think Betty got a lot of that from her mother. Betty was a tomboy, but then her mother wanted to instill some femininity into her. So when she was 8 years old, she enrolled her in the Calatravis School of Dancing in Grand Rapids. And Betty says that dance was her happiness. From the moment she took her first ballroom dance class wearing black patent leather Mary Jane shoes and white gloves, she loved everything about dance and then took ballet and tap and eventually really fell in love with modern dance. She wasn't a great student, but everything she did with dance, she got A pluses.
Well, in fact, as we see in your book, Lisa McCubbin, she winds up going to New York and studying with and dancing for Martha Graham, although she didn't make the A touring company. But how do you think that time as a dancer and as a performer, how did that resonate through her time in the White House as First Lady?
Dancing, first of all, gave her tremendous poise and grace and discipline. So much discipline was involved with the dance and just getting everything perfect. So she was a perfectionist in so many ways. And also she loved fashion. She would design her own dance costumes and put on performances when she went back to Grand Rapids. So the dance and the fashion, I think, really contributed to her being this beautiful, lovely, gracious first lady that she would eventually become.
And she was thrust into the White House when Richard Nixon resigned in August of 1974. She and President Ford never campaigned for this. Did she enjoy the role or not?
You know, she said that the day she entered the White House in 1974 was the saddest day of her life. So, no, she really didn't want this. It was a terrible time in the country. She had been very close friends with Pat Nixon, and she felt terrible for the humiliation that her friend was going through. And she and Gerry Ford felt betrayed by Richard Nixon. It was really tough, but she blossomed in the White House. It was just 7 weeks after she became First Lady that she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and that really changed things.
We forget that it was so soon, and she broke new ground in the way America talked about and confronted breast cancer.
Absolutely. You know, it's hard to believe now, but in 1974, you couldn't say the word breast on television. When people had cancer, it was just whispered about. Breast cancer was just referred to as a woman's disease. There was no research. There was no walkathons. And literally overnight, when Betty Ford came out publicly and said she was going through this, that she had a mastectomy, literally that changed women's health care overnight. Women started lining up at doctors' offices, calling their doctors to get breast exams because Betty said, you know, early detection is what saved my life and gives me a good prognosis.
We see very clearly in your book, Betty Ford, that she certainly wrestled with drug and alcohol addictions, prescription drug addictions. And it's almost as if her story of her addiction could be torn from today's headlines.
Yes, she had a pinched nerve and was in excruciating neck pain. And the doctors said they couldn't operate, so they prescribed pain meds. And when Betty was leaving the hospital, this is when she was in her 40s, she was leaving the hospital and she was so concerned. She asked the doctor, well, what do I do if I'm out somewhere and, you know, the pain comes back? And the doctor said, don't let that happen. Take your medication every 4 hours. So, you know, she was following doctor's orders and she would become accustomed to one level of pain medication and then they'd have to prescribe something stronger. You know, I think this is very common today, and it got to the point where she was taking a lot of different things prescribed by doctors. And it was just one doctor. It wasn't like she was going to a bunch of different doctors. The White House doctor was giving her all these medications. Some of her assistants who were working with her noticed in the White House that there was something not quite right. After she would take some of her meds, she would be sleepy and her words would be slurred. So they went to the doctor, and he basically told them to mind their own business. You know, it's something that I hope people can learn a lesson from and see the relevance. It is so easy to become reliant and dependent on prescription drugs. You think, oh, the doctor's prescribing this because it's good for me.
Lisa McCubbin, you open your Betty Ford biography with the family intervention. That was a very new thing at the time when everybody in her family sat down and confronted her not only about her prescription drug abuse, but her drinking, which, as you show us, has some deep roots in her family history.
It did. One thing that I uncovered and something that really the Ford family had never really talked about was Betty's father died when she was 16. It was an apparent suicide. At his funeral, she learned that her father had been an alcoholic. It wasn't something she'd ever witnessed because he traveled so much. It would turn out that one of her older brothers also was an alcoholic. Definitely a family disease. And the intervention was so painful for the family, but I spoke with all four of the Ford children, and they were all very open and candid with me. They felt like the time was right to reveal a lot of these really personal stories about their mother.
And it is stunning when we really see through your book Betty's journey from being so close to dying from her addictions to become a founder of the Betty Ford Center and helping heaven knows how many others to recovery. What was it in her character, do you think, that helped her, you know, gut it out and make that journey to recovery and then on to helping others?
Well, I really think that goes back to her Michigan roots. When she was growing up, her mother was very involved in charitable organizations. She worked at the Mary Freebed Center, and Betty would go there and work with children who were disabled from polio, and some couldn't move their arms, some couldn't move their legs. And she would come in and put on a record and teach them to dance in whatever way they could. You know, she just wanted to help people. She had this compassionate nature, and she had an attitude that, you know, yeah, bad things happen, but it's not the end of the world, and you just need to move forward. And she would always try to find the silver lining in everything. She just had this wonderful attitude.
You know, something that struck me as I read your book, Lisa McCubbin, and it's a theme that we see throughout Betty's life as a political wife, was how absolutely unafraid she was to enjoy friendships and associations with wives from the other side of the aisle, which is very striking in 2018 when we see such intense political polarization. Tell us more about that.
Well, it was a different world in Washington back then. The congressmen all lived in Washington, which they don't these days. So, you know, they're commuting back and forth. Their families basically are living wherever the districts they're from. So back then, the families were all living in Washington, and the wives of the congressmen would become friends. A lot of the kids went to school together. So, you know, kids don't see politics, you know, unless they're taught that from their parents. So they would socialize together, and it really was a completely different environment. The other thing that I discovered while writing this book was this wonderful love story between Gerald and Betty Ford, and the admiration and respect they had for each other. Jerry really relied on Betty for a lot of things. He would turn to her for advice, and she would give it. And it wasn't always along party lines. And she would say things in the press that maybe might make him cringe, but he would support her fully by saying, well, she is a woman and she has her own mind and she has every right to say what she believes in.
What most touched you as you researched and wrote your account of Betty Ford's life?
Oh, gosh, what most touched me? The most touching part was when I was writing about President Ford's funeral, and I just felt this overwhelming sadness because she lost her true love and her boyfriend. She called him her boyfriend until the day he died, and that was a really touching moment for me to kind of research what went on with the funeral and how strong she was and this tremendous sense of loss of losing her great love.
Where do you think she stands in the pantheon of America's first ladies?
Oh, well, she's my favorite, no doubt about that. But, you know, I think many historians have said that Betty Ford's legacy is one of few first ladies who outshines her husband. And she just the impact she's had on women's health and then on addiction treatment and alcoholism, the hundreds of thousands of lives she has saved by using her platform to speak out and do good in the world. You know, she didn't just put her name on the Betty Ford Center. She was there every day. She was talking to patients. Her vision is still there everywhere, and she was just beloved by people who worked there and still work there.
Lisa McCubbin, her book is Betty Ford, First Lady, Woman's Advocate, Survivor, Trailblazer. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Oh, thank you. Hope everybody gets a chance to read it.
It's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Earlier in the show, Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta walked us through the changes that have been made in Michigan's fireworks law since 2011. Expanding sale of more powerful fireworks may have increased revenue, but it lit a short fuse of complaints about excessive noise. But griping about the noise of fireworks around the 4th is not new. In 1909, anti-noise campaigners were trying to restrict fireworks nationally, including making an appeal to Michigan's Governor Fred Warner. Here to tell us more about these early anti-noise campaigners is State Archivist Mark Harvey. So, Mark, who was behind this group and what was their name?
The person behind it was a woman named Julia Barnett, Rice, the group became known as the Society for the Suppression of Unnecessary Noise, which I really want a t-shirt that has that on it.
You know what? I'm with you. Make me a t-shirt that says the same thing. So what brought Julia Barnett Rice into this battle to suppress unnecessary noise?
When you introduce that topic, you think, wow, that sounds sort of fringe. But she was a legitimate trained physician. She didn't actually practice, but she was a trained physician, had friends at the Bellevue Hospital in New York City. And those people that worked there noted to her that the tugboats in the harbor were really disturbing the patients at night. They were just blaring their horns all night. They were actually noting health effects of their patients because they weren't getting good sleep or they were startled. It was a real problem. And Julia looked at this and took it on as her crusade and went after the tugboat captains in force.
And she was living in New York City, which itself is a place with a lot of noise.
Yeah. And people characterized her society as an anti-noise society, which she always would correct them and say, no, we're a society for the suppression of unnecessary noise. We understand there's going to be noise. But deep down, I think she just didn't like it. She had her own house soundproofed. So I think she just didn't like noise. But she went after those tugboat captains and affected change through Bennett's Law in 1907. And if you were cited for sounding your tugboat horn unnecessarily, you were suspended. It was legitimate.
And it had consequences. So how did this get from, we need to stifle these tugboat toots, you know, in the East River or the Hudson River, to a national campaign that brought her to Michigan's governor?
Well, her success with Bennett's Law gained her the attention of influential people in New York. So she didn't waste a moment in going after her real nemesis, holidays. And she cited the four major holidays at the time. She listed them as Christmas, Halloween, Election Day, and then her least favorite, which she dubbed the Barbarous Fourth. And it was the fourth that she really put her crosshairs on. You know, I talk a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but she was really a pioneer in this. This is someone that is understanding the role of auditory disturbance in people's health. So that's significant. And she was mostly concerned about children when it came to the 4th of July. To the extent that she was able to get Mark Twain to be her chairperson for her children's branch of the society. So again, a person not to be trifled with.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, the national campaign was her writing to every governor in the United States, including Michigan's Governor Fred Warner, asking them to join her committee against the noise on the 4th of July.
So was she trying to stamp out fireworks? Was that the idea? Like she didn't want to just eliminate the 4th of July, but it was the fireworks aspect of it?
Yeah, so I don't think the noise itself was a compelling statistic. So she actually cites in her letter that between 1903 and 1907, over 1,500 people were killed as a result of the 4th of July. Now, if we really put that to the truth test, I think it's probably accurate that 1,500 people died on the 4th of July, but I don't think it was from fireworks. You know, that includes people being murdered, hit by a carriage or automobile, accidental death. She can cite those stats, but I don't think they relate directly to events of celebrating the 4th.
Now, did Governor Warner respond to this request at all?
Governor Warner did respond. And remember, this is a very influential person from New York City writing to a politician, asking him to join her national committee to help preserve children's health. So not a whole lot of wiggle room for his response. So he responded, "Dear Madam, I'm writing to acknowledge receipt of your esteemed favor. I take pleasure in complying with your request regarding the use of my name as a member on the National Committee for the promotion of a safe and sane 4th of July. Yours very truly, Governor Fred Warner."
And you know what? That works. It says everything and does nothing.
Right? Right? You can use my name.
Yeah. And the fact that we are still discussing fireworks on the 4th of July means that the campaign didn't succeed.
Well, it succeeded to a certain extent because in 1931, when Michigan's penal code was written and codified, that was the first big penal code for Michigan, smack dab in the middle of it is the prohibition of fireworks. It basically lays out that long arc of a law that affected me in my childhood, which this might sound familiar to you, Cynthia. Mm. It only made legal snakes, sparklers, and strip caps less than 0.25 grams of powder. So my cap guns, they just were never powerful enough.
No, and I had the same ones because playing cowboys was my life, and those little strips of caps, I remember them very, very
well. You had to use a hammer.
So if people are kind of gritting their teeth at the sound of fireworks and the like over the next few days, your spirit animal was Julia Barnett Rice, the head of the Society for the Suppression of Unnecessary Noise. That's State Archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center. Mark, happy safe 4th of July to you.
Happy, safe, and sane 4th of July to you, Cynthia.
On July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon, a dangerous and ambitious mission that could have failed at so many moments. Tomorrow, Michigan Radio will air a special episode of The Pulse. It'll explore the science that got us to the moon, the politics that push space exploration, and our relationship with the moon. Also, how people around the country remember and celebrated the moon landing. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and have a very safe and fun Independence Day.